Hello and welcome to Bloodhound Picks. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Craig.
I'm Kyle.
And I'm Josh.
And this episode is a very special one. It is our 100th episode. And after I'll say that, Kyle will bring in a special effect or something to make it even more 100th episode. Yeah. Because we are talking in front of a live audience. But for our 100th episode, we wanted to switch things up. Normally, we either focus on obscure or entirely independent works, we'll do our screener spotlight, or we'll kind of interview members of the indie horror community. But we kind of wanted to do something closer to our heart and also talk about, you know, obviously a big thing on kind of what horror Twitter, I guess as it's called, is the aspect of gatekeeping and what movies are, or what movies will make you kind of an official horror fan and things like that. And there's always kind of back and forth and people yelling about it and stuff like that. So we wanted to take, you know, these movies that are always considered essential, you know, horror films that you need to see to be a horror fan that we have not seen, to prove that, yeah, you get the point. So each one of us chose a movie that we have not seen, but the other two have. We have a classic, important sequel in kind of a popular franchise, and we have a modern horror movie that I guess many people consider changed the game a little bit, or it's just a very, you know, important modern horror film. And so, should we give them what they are, or let them be surprised as we're going through it?
We can give them away.
Okay.
Because I'm sure I will in the description.
Yeah. So Josh is going to be talking about The Wicker Man, which he just watched for the first time. After that, I will be discussing Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warrior, which these
Warriors.
Two love.
Yeah,
Warriors.
Say, Jesus, get the fucking title right.
It matters.
Right.
It's plural.
Yeah. Okay. And then Kyle is talking about The Conjuring. We're just kind of saying our opinions, where, and then we'll get into more discussion on it. But this is our 100th episode, so enjoy.
Yay.
Josh, you want to go first with The Wicker Man?
I could a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul, freeze thy young blood.
Here to investigate the disappearance of a young girl. Where is Rowan Morrison?
If Rowan Morrison existed, we would know.
I suspect murder.
Sergeant, I've already...
In the name of God, woman, what kind of mother are you that can stand by and see your own child slaughtered?
You are the fool, Mr. Harvey.
You're liars. You are despicable little liars.
Oh my God!
Yeah, sure, I can do that. So apparently my horror cred is in pretty good shape because this was a challenge for me to come up with anything. And it actually took a lot of researching for me to fucking figure this out. However, I feel I chose The Wicker Man from 73. And I actually did come up with one that would have been better, but I couldn't find it. And the only way I could, see it was to pay, and I wasn't going to pay for it.
What movie was that? Yeah.
The Omen.
Okay.
And it took me going through the, you guys seen the documentary on Bravo, the 100 greatest horror, which is the greatest fucking horror documentary of all time. Anyway, so I went through that list. And I think I had seen out of the 100, I think I'd seen 98 of them. Oh, okay. So the only two that I hadn't were The Wicker Man and The Omen. Anyhow, so I chose The Wicker Man. Unfortunately, I had seen the fucking remake. So, you know, some of it was sort of spoiled. I mean, granted, they are vastly different, but, you know, there's obviously some things that are exactly the same. So that was sort of annoying. I was pretty taken aback at how fucking weird the movie was. I know it was the 70s, so, you know, hippie shit was just rampant in this film. Even though it was, a British production, I believe. But fuck, hippies are everywhere. So, and it was just funny to me too. Like the, you know, you have this detective who gets, I'm going to spoil a fucking 48-year-old film. Yes. So fuck off. but you get a detective, you know, who's basically, manipulated into going and searching for this girl who's not really missing. Also that these fucking hippie pagan weirdos can sacrifice him so that they can grow crops in an area that doesn't grow crops, which is fucking hilarious. So, you know, the guy is being played the entire time. Obviously we find out things in the same exact way that he does. And the guy is like this really devout Christian. And so he gets really upset that these people on this island don't think the same way, which is like, Jesus Christ, guy, people don't have to think the same way you do. It's fine. But, you know, it really bothers him. And I thought it was just hilarious too. Like, you know, these people on this island are all fucking just beyond weird. And this dude is like the most straight-laced fucking guy that you could ever imagine. And it takes him so long to just be like, fuck this, I'm leaving. Which, you know, in reality probably would have happened within, I don't know, 20 minutes at the most of actual like screen time of the runtime. And of course it's too late at that point. But I really liked it. It was as I was going through it, it was kind of astounding that a remake of this movie was even attempted, because it is very 70s, right? It's like a product of that time. And I don't think it's really a surprise that there aren't quote unquote folk horror films. With the possible exception being Midsommar. But obviously that's an exception, because how many other folk horror movies are there? I mean, honestly, I don't know that there are any. I'm sure there are, but so the whole prospect of remaking this movie to me was just, I can see exactly how that experiment failed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it failed so bad compared especially to the original movie. It's just one of those things where it's like, it's such, the original movie is such a product of the time it was made.
Yeah.
And you know, trying to replicate that, or however you want to fucking phrase it, you know, 40 years later, I mean, it's not going to work. And I mean, Nicolas Cage can be in it all you want, and it's just, you know, it's not going to happen. And Christopher Lee, you know, is again, just a fucking marvel as usual. And in this movie, you know, you can tell he's just having a great time being this fucking weirdo, kind of like, you know, he's the lord of this island, and he's got really bad wigs, and, you know, it's just, it's great. And, you know, Christopher Lee is the more I see of Christopher Lee, I actually just saw, which I almost would have chosen this, but I'd seen it. Recently I saw, Devil Rides Out. And he is just fucking great in that too. Which would have been a few years before, Wicker Man. So, I mean, in that time too, you know, Christopher Lee's entire career was pretty much brilliant, but especially in this time frame, I mean, dude was like, you know, he was one of the titans of the genre. For sure. And this was no different. So I loved it. I thought it was really fucking weird. And you're just not going to get anything like this again, I don't think.
No.
I could see it, and I agree. And I think because with the remake, there might, like with Midsommar, with Ari Aster, there's a couple films now where I think audiences are okay with that. Like Slow Burn or that Dread or whatever, especially during the time when the remake came out, you know, it was all about, you know, jump scares. It was all about was that when Hostel and Saw were, and all that stuff were like, you know, it was either torture porn or jump scare related.
Yeah. And cause the remake was 06.
Yeah. So then, yeah, it was just all, you couldn't make a horror movie that was, without in your face scary moments. And I think, you know, folk horror is so much based on just kind of that, you know, little bit of dread. Or, and then there's Kill List, which is the only one that I can really think of that came out around that same time. But that's the same way, where it has, but that even goes darker than, you know, The Wicker Man, because you're dealing with a hitman and, you know, pedophiles, and that it has that twist ending, which I won't spoil. You should watch Kill List by Ben Wheatley.
But, well, and that one also fucks with genre much though too, which, you know, cause it seems like it's one thing and then it turns into something completely different.
Yeah. But yeah. I agree with the folk horror aspect. It is a hard one to pull off, but I know a lot of people are, because it is a very European genre too, in a weird way.
Yeah.
But
The Wicker Man, I think, does it the best though. Yeah. Just comparing it to like Midsommar, even though you're not comparing these two movies, I'm gonna compare them because what I think is better about The Wicker Man is the mystery plot. Is he has a reason to be there and a reason not to leave because he's there. Because as weird as these people are, he's looking for someone. Versus like. Midsommar, she's just on a trip. Like, she could totally leave. There's no, like, ulterior plot to drive the narrative through the slow burn to the twist.
Yeah. Well, and I think we've seen it so long that it's, we know it was coming by Midsommar. And we've talked about this in episodes prior. I actually really enjoyed Midsommar. But yeah, you know something eerie is happening, where with watching The Wicker Man, you know, for that first time, as long as, you know, the ending wasn't spoiled for you, you know, since you're finding it out, the information out as he is, you know, that has a really major twist. I mean, obviously, because of either the remake and the Nicolas Cage with the bees meme or whatever, we kind of know, you know, it's like going into, I don't know, Star Wars now and knowing that Darth Vader is the father, or many of the twists, like Wicker Man is kind of one of those ones where it's a major Hollywood or a major film twist, I think. And film,
and they try to remake it anyways.
Yeah.
So dumb.
So yeah, it was great. So I think I guess I have got one more to just all out fucking solidify my fucking horror cred in concrete.
And then you're done.
I'm done. I don't need to see anything else.
Yeah.
I'm never watching a movie again after I see The Omen.
And I was going to say, I was thinking the whole time, like, oh, if only we planned this earlier, I could have just sent you, because I have an extra copy, I think, of The Omen. I could just send it to him. But, yeah. So, next up, we are talking about the film that I am watching for the first time, which I know Kyle has been
finally
for years. And
Josh, say it so we can boo.
I think it was called Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Freddy's Dead.
Boo. No.
The Dream Warriors.
Yes.
Street Part 3. Freddy's just around the corner.
Fucker can't even get the title right.
It was going to be a double feature where I was also going to do Nightmare on Elm Street 4. The Dream Master, right?
Yeah. You can do that another time. Or yeah. You just did 3, right?
Yeah. Greg was too scared. Basically what he was saying.
They're scary movies, Craig.
Yeah.
So up until this point, I have seen, franchise horror for me is kind of that one of those weird ones where I know I'm missing a couple of the Halloween, the Resurrection one, and the ones that people always talk about now you don't really need to see. And Josh is having an aneurysm. But with Nightmare on Elm Street, I've seen the original. The first one I ever saw was when it came out, because I know my brother rented it, was actually New Nightmare. So I've seen that one. I've seen Nightmare 2, Freddy versus Jason, all those, whatever, the remake. And then 6, Freddy's Dead, the one with his daughter, and the video game one, or Death. And that's, I'm missing that 3 to 5 chunk where they're all kind of connected through I don't know. What I realized is it's like a character who's the main character in the one prior dies in the next one, and then a new character kind of takes over, and then that character dies. Whereas Nancy in 1, they erase 2, basically. That's not on, or is it? I don't know if it's canon or whatever, but.
It's just never, like, referenced. So yeah. It's not. Technically, well, not, it's not canon, but
no, it's not though, because they completely changed the rules.
Yeah,
and then obviously, with 3, you have the Nancy character, so they almost do sort of retcon it, but it's a fine movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I liked it. It was fun. It was a lot of the kills, like the television one, the puppet one, and. Maybe one more I'd seen before, just because especially with a lot of horror movie clips or stuff like that, those ones pop up very frequently.
You mean considering it's like one of the most beloved sequels and one of the most beloved franchises of fucking all time, you've probably seen some of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
It's no nightmare, or no new nightmare, I'll say that. But I'm just messing more with Kyle and Josh because I know how much they love it. But, no, I liked it a lot. It was a lot of fun. I think it has, it's interesting going to it because Freddy, I don't know, by now I've seen so many of the future ones that going back, remembering that Freddy, even though he has his one-liners in this, like he's still very evil. Where, you know, when you get into something, even like Freddy's Dead, it's just...
It's a fucking comedy.
Yeah, it's screwball. Yeah. He's just making zingers left and right and whatever it may be. But, yeah, the characters were great. I like Nancy. I like kind of all of it. It wasn't really a major issue that I had with it. It was just... Yeah, it was a fun movie, and I guess it is one of those ones, I guess, via proxy. Again, we were just mentioning about it popping up so much that even though I hadn't seen it, there are elements where I was like, oh, it's like, I felt like I had watched it, through other people talking about it enough. But yeah, I enjoyed it, and I will watch number 4. I heard 5 is... I'll just watch them all. Why not?
Yeah, you might as well. 4 and 5 go together, kind of, okay. You know?
Yeah, I know it's the same kind of main character.
Yeah.
They couldn't keep Patricia Arquette, though.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obvious reasons.
She has an Oscar now.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it is funny as fuck, too, that they had both her and Larry Fishburne in a Nightmare film together. I mean,
so good.
That's what amazing. I wish there was more of him. That was my big complaint. Yeah. I was like, man, I really like his character.
Yeah, and it's funny because he is just such a minor part, but yeah, he's fucking great every time he's in there.
I was gonna say too, I've never thought about this till now, but like, he doesn't get killed, does he? He just like disappears.
No, he just disappears. Yeah.
Because he's an adult, since he's an adult or whatever, he's not.
Yeah.
He doesn't dream.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, I don't dream anymore.
That's the other thing, though, too, is like, it's, I mean, our dreams are broken. It adds so much good fucking lore in this one, though, like with the history of his mother and what happened, and then like just the idea that like this has been going on so long that there's only like 6 kids left that he's still after or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool ideas.
Yeah. Which then it makes it, I guess, going from watching later, it makes it strange with kind of some of the lore because, like, well, if there's only these couple of kids left,
yeah,
and then, you know, you watch later and he's going after more kids. And, yeah, so there's a little bit of that issue, but that's with the other movies, I guess, and not this one specifically.
Yeah,
it is one of those things where you arguably could, I'm not going to do it, but somebody could make the argument that it's better than the original movie. And it's just because of the amount of good shit in terms of mythology that was created with, you know, Robert Englund. Because, you know, it is like, you don't get any of that in the original film, as great of a movie as it is.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. That and Nancy character, I mean, that's just fucking heartbreaking, man.
It was.
Fuck, well, I'm still not over it.
And John Saxon being like a grumpy drunk is fucking great.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah. Again, John Saxon. I mean, fuck, dude.
So good.
Nope, but yeah. So that is, guess, my interpretation of Nightmare on Elm Street 3. Now I won't be hassled anymore.
I don't know about that.
Oh, you're still gonna fucking hear it every
I'm
day.
Just gonna be like, didn't watch it 30 more times, Craig? What were you doing, taking care of your daughter?
You didn't buy the box set?
Oh my god, you don't have the fucking box set? I have fucking two of them.
Unbelievable.
You have one for each TV.
I have the DVD set and the Blu-ray set.
All we're going to learn about gatekeeping from this episode is that, like, it's never enough. It doesn't matter what you do. It's never enough.
You could watch all...
You suck.
Yeah, you could watch all 100 moments, or all 100 horror films on the Bravo 100 Scary Moments and still not be enough.
Never.
So next up, we are talking modern horror, and Kyle is going to be talking about The Conjuring.
All right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own. Give us a sign that you want to communicate with us.
Nothing.
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
There's someone here that would like to talk to you.
There's something horrible happening in my house.
November 1st, 1971, I'm sitting here with Carolyn Perrin, who, with her family, has been experiencing supernatural occurrences.
You picking up anything in here, hon?
Something awful happened here, Ed.
What is it?
Whatever Lorraine sees, feels, touches, it takes a toll on her. A little piece each time.
You have a lot of spirits in here, but there's one that I'm most worried about because it is so hateful. Here.
That's not gonna help.
This thing has latched itself to your family.
Father, we never seen nothing like this.
I'm coming with you.
No way. I can't lose you.
There's a lady in a dirty nightgown that I see in my dreams. She's standing in front of my mom's bed.
Do you want to see him?
Yeah.
When the music stops, you see him in the mirror standing behind you.
Look what she made me do.
Kyle watched it for the first time, and Kyle, tell us your thoughts.
Yes. So this and... So basically this Insidious... what is the other one? Sinister, like, when they all came out, to me, they were just kind of all lumped together as one thing that I was like, it just seemed very mainstream, so I was like, I'm probably not going to care that much, you know? Although,
kids, possession.
Yeah, well, they all look the same. They all do kind of, like, well, and that's marketing, too, or whatever, yeah. But... And I like Sinister a lot, probably, of the three. But I'd never seen this. And I like James Wan for the most part. I mean, a lot of it is more mainstream than I care for, I guess. But it was really well made. Everything about it was solid. But at the same time, I think for me, and this is like probably why I didn't watch it, is just... It's a lot of stuff we've seen before. I mean, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, it happens, but it's a lot of, you know, the only thing I even wrote as notes was just greatest hits. That's kind of what it feels like is like, you know, like we all love Poltergeist. We all have seen The Exorcist. We've all seen a lot of these movies and it's taking from each one of those and putting together. And it's also, you know, kind of a haunted house movie, a possession movie disguised as a haunted house movie. And I don't know. I'm not a big fan of possession movies either.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know why, but, but still, I mean, it's solid. I can see why people love it. And it was interesting to me probably too, because like, obviously I'd heard about the Annabelle series and I've heard about this whole series and the fact that they like intro that doll in the beginning of this, I was like, oh, okay. Now I know what all this shit is about.
Yeah.
It also felt a little bit long too with that, where I was like, this is interesting. And normally I would probably, normally this would be like an asset because you're like investing in all these different characters and like trying to make them a little bit deeper than maybe they normally would. But I was like, man, you had a prologue that was like 15 minutes that comes back to be important. But we're also like just jumping around from like the Exorcist and the family and all these people and having like character building scenes. And I'm just like, man, we don't need that shit. Come on. I don't care. You got Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. I don't need to see them talking about their daughter. Like, let's. We don't need to go to the Vatican and talk to the dude. Like, you can just say you're going to go do that, and we can cut to the next scene.
Yeah, that's all the any possession movie in the 21st century has. It's like an essential Vatican meeting.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Why is that interesting?
Yeah.
It's definitely not.
Yeah.
The two other things, and I was talking to Craig about this, was like, I kind of hate period movies that are Hollywood-ish, I guess you would say, even though this isn't like a Hollywood film, but it just, like, they have the right hairstyles, they have all this stuff, but it just feels false. There's just something about it where it feels like, I love 70s movies, so I'm going to set a movie in the 70s, but it's all just going to feel like fake. You know, I don't know. It's lacking the authenticity that inspired the decision to set it in that period. And the other thing was knowing, and it's a movie, so the reality of those characters isn't really to be brought to bear, but obviously the couple, the Warrens, were not like legit.
Yeah.
But in the context of the movie, it was kind of annoying, though, still, where, like, Patrick Wilson, a lot of his whole character and a lot of his scenes was just him being like, don't touch that. Like, this shit is real and I'm important and I know you think it's a joke, but it's serious.
Yeah.
I was like, he doesn't have to do that in five scenes.
Yeah. Well, and they're kind of, I get it. So, for people that watch The Conjuring, and you know, like, that was the whole slew of all those movies too, where it's like it's based on a true story, and then, you know, it kind of markets it that way and does all that thing. It's not really. And I'm sorry to be the one to burst your bubble. And the Warrens, they weren't great people. They weren't like that great people. So, and they're kind of pushing a certain agenda too.
Yeah.
And so, but we won't get into that part. We'll just talk about the Conjuring movies themselves.
Well, just one more thing, though. It is sort of astounding how the light that is painted around those two real people when it's like the exact opposite in real life, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, no, they were fucking con artists. They weren't fucking good people at all.
Yeah.
But for some reason, like, just don't have that. Just make up two fucking characters that are married, that are husband and wife, that are fucking, you know, ghost hunters or whatever the fuck. That, you know?
You could say loosely based on or whatever.
Sure.
Like,
You
read my mind. That's what I was going to say, too. What's weird is it feels like someone involved in the making of somewhere has an agenda to, you know, to, like, fix their image or something.
Yeah.
It's like,
yep.
Is this a movie about a possession, or is this like a PR campaign for these people? Because we're spending a lot of time like polishing their
showing
reputation.
How good they are, and look at all the good things that they do. It's like, fuck you. None of that's true.
Well, it's not important to the story, like
at all. Yeah.
Well, and
is this a PR movie, or is this a fucking possession movie?
Well, and the sequels get into that even more. I don't know. It seems like each sequel has more and more elements of like how good they are and how important. Which when she's seeing the nun and all that stuff in the second one and things like that, it's like, oh, they treat it like they're the chosen ones, you know. Well, based under the veil of this is a true story.
The irony is, if you wrote something that was based on who they actually were, would be so much more interesting.
Oh, fuck, dude. Yes. It would. Yes. I mean, it's unreal to even think, like, how much more interesting and better that would be.
That's what we got to do.
Well, I mean, they're both passed away now, so no one's going to stop you.
Good. I'm going to write my script Conjuring Smondering.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, it should probably be mentioned, too. I actually just thought of this, that our grad school mentor is in love with this movie.
Yes. Which... That's why I watched... So I saw the second one.
And he fucking hates everything, but for some reason he's in love with this.
Yeah. I saw the second one because I was working at the Chinese Theater at the time and it was playing, so I watched it. And then, I watched this one because he brought it up and because he showed us the clip. He's like, this is the one where jump scares are actually effective and how you do a perfect jump scare. All this stuff I watched it, I was like, it's a good jump scare. That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
And it's like, it's James Wan.
Yeah. So of course it's going to be a good jump scare.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't care about the characters. But, I thought of another thing I have to bring up is, so in the movie they mention... Like, they have that picture of the family and their day at the beach, and this is, like, a very special memory that comes up later in the climax. Spoiler alert, when the mom is possessed and they're trying to bring her back. But it was, it reminded me of another trope that I hate just in movies where, like, this movie was so long that we could have had, in the beginning, there could have been a scene of the family at the beach having this great time. We could have experienced that with them, and then it would have been more impactful when it came up again later. But instead, we see a picture, we hear them talk about it, and then we see, like, quick cuts of this memory, and I'm like, that has no resonance because I wasn't there. I don't care. It's important to her. It's not important to me because I wasn't there because you didn't write a good scene that would have mattered to me. And that. This is why I never watched this movie, because I knew that it would be an existential experience, you know, for me.
That's a good point. They try to make the, and it's, if you haven't seen the movie, you're probably like, shut, you guys sound like morons, but there really is this, the Lily Taylor is the mother, and she does have this memory that, you know, is this like, wonderful experience, you know, on vacation with her, because she has like what, 12 kids and her husband, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, except for this isn't, I don't really give a shit about your vacation. I mean, great.
Yeah.
And then it, like, they make it seem like it's like the most important thing on the face of the earth later, and it's like, okay.
It's so weird to me, just given how long the movie is and the way it's structured. It's like, you had that prologue with the doll. Yep. Right after that, you could have gone to the beach scene and introduced the whole family and done, you know, whatever you needed to do, and then had them go to their house or whatever. Like, there was totally enough room to do it, kind of.
Well, it feels like, I don't know, and I guess James Wan is a master at this, of making successful franchises. And that's what a lot of this movie feels like, too, is it's like, well, let's add in a bunch of stuff that technically isn't important to the movie, but it will set up for the sequels later. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Is that the sequel, The Conjuring 2, that day at the beach?
No. Day at the beach. It's actually a happy one.
It's an entire hour and a half. Yeah. Like the literal,
it's a prequel.
Time.
It's a prequel of just the family vacation.
Yeah, it's basically like a Richard Linklater film or something. It's just just them talking.
And then at the end, she's just like, God, this is such a good day. I hope I don't become possessed or something.
Yeah.
As they move into that house.
Yeah.
That's the way it ends.
But, you know, that it's like, they did. They put so much emphasis on the Annabelle to yeah. set up for like the Annabelle, its own franchise. And the, I don't know. I think that was the issue I had with it, watching it.
But was that predetermined? Because
no, it was,
to me, that was the best part of the movie, and they realized after the fact, like, oh, fuck, we should just make a goddamn franchise of this doll. That would have been the smart thing to do. So they did it.
Yeah, it could have been. No, I just, yeah, for some reason with movies now, maybe because of all the stuff that we watch for this podcast or whatever it may be, but I just want a movie that is just
a movie.
And just tells a complete story without having to watch another movie to be able to watch, you know, get into that movie. And then
it's the same reason I hate salesmen. It's like I bought the one thing, but I don't want to buy three more things. I just need one. I don't need the plans for next summer's blockbuster. Like, just stop.
In Conjuring movies and salesmen.
Yeah.
They're basically the same thing.
They are the fucking same thing.
So, that was our take on these three movies. We have apparently two movies we had high opinions on, and one not so much. But that was our 100th episode, where we just wanted to kind of show that no matter how much horror you watch or anything, there's still more to watch. That doesn't mean you're a true horror fan if you haven't seen it or whatever it may be that is constantly brought up, unless you haven't seen The Exorcist.
Yeah. Just no matter what, you're never enough. Yeah.
But, yeah. So, you know, enjoy the horror you want. And this was fun, kind of going through watching it. We, of course, want to do more kind of things like this, more specials. Let us know what you want. We also talked about in the future, which was another one of our big plans, doing some audio commentaries. So please send us a comment, messages, whatever you want, about your opinions on these movies, if you agree or disagree, and what you'd like to hear from us in the future, because we also want to start covering, you know, kind of bigger films that are beloved, and, you know, and doing more kind of fun things like that. So let us know. And as always, have a great rest of your day, and see ya.
Bloodhound Picks Podcast is part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network, produced by Josh Lee, Craig Drum, and Kyle Hintz. Music by Raymond Seed. Editing by Kyle Hintz.